Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Today we're talking about talking, and I'll start by stating the obvious. Words are important. What we say, what we don't say, how much we say, how we say it. Our words build relationships, they can also ruin relationships. Just the other day, one of my dear sisters shared with me that my words in a previous conversation had hurt her. It wasn't so much what I'd said, but the timing and the way I'd said it that was hurtful. I'd been careless with my words. But thankfully, she's a very gracious person, and when I apologised, she forgave and we moved on. I'm sure we can all recall things that people have said to us that have had a profound impact on us, for better or worse. We teach our children to use words instead of just whining or growling. We say things like, use your words, try again. Words are important. Well, this week is the third week in our series on the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to be looking at just the first seven verses of chapter 5, where the writer, the teacher, as he calls himself, has something to say about how we should approach God. In particular, how we should use our words when we come before God. But let's step back a bit and look again at the broader context before we dive into chapter 5. So Ecclesiastes is part of what we call the wisdom literature, and it sits alongside another wisdom book, the book of Proverbs. Now, Proverbs teaches us how to live successfully with the grain of the universe. It's dealing with a cause and effect universe where, on average, in general, when you work hard and save money, you prosper. When you plan, that's better than not planning. But the book of Ecclesiastes is offering a different kind of wisdom. The teacher wants us to know that part of the pattern of the universe is that not everything follows a pattern. Proverbs is kind of like your parents, the ones who offer prudent life advice. Make sure you marry well. Go to uni and don't do the arts degree. Do the law degree. Get your superannuation sorted out. That's the kind of advice that Proverbs gives. And then Ecclesiastes is like your offbeat, quirky uncle who you find smoking on the back porch at the family reunion. And he says, hey, listen up. Have you worked out that if you don't go to uni, you can actually do pretty well for yourself? Take the backpacking trip to South America. Life's short. Do the arts degree. I think we all need an uncle like that. And that's Ecclesiastes. So the teacher's key observation, he says it 37 times in the book, is that everything in the world is meaningless.
You cannot shut down conversation.
This Hebrew word, hevel, that's translated meaningless in the NIV, it's often used as a picture word, meaning mist or vapour. So when some mornings when I walk the kids to school, it's misty. And by the time I turn around and walk home, it's gone, evaporated. Mist is not a bad thing, but it's not something you can possess, not something you can hold on to or control. Or like dreams, which are so vivid, so real, you wake up with your heart pounding in fear, but within moments, the images fade. Once I had this dream where I composed an entire symphony. I really did. And it was all in Technicolor and the harmonies were incredible. And then I woke up. I tried to hold on to the notes, to the euphoria, the colours, but it evaporated. It was nothing. Havel, vapour, meaningless. And the teacher wants us to come to terms with the fact that much more of life is like this than you or I care to notice. In chapters 1-4, the teacher establishes that because we are on earth, under the sun, as he expresses it, and subject to death, we can't hold on to things. We can't control outcomes. Pleasure, wealth, success, knowledge even, it all evaporates. We can't gain any lasting profit from them. So many things that we think are solid, the teacher says. No, it's all fleeting, insubstantial, meaningless, a vapour. So many of the things that we're committed to turn out differently to how we expect or plan, hashtag 2020. Many of us ended up doing this thing called remote learning and had to relearn long division and watch BTN. What was that? Our plans for our education, our finances, even sometimes our relationships, friendships that we can't imagine fading. Over time, they fade, slip away. Havel. So life can't be about those things, which raises the question, then what is life about? Well, thankfully, the teacher is not just trying to depress us. He's here to help. He wants to move us toward fear of the Lord. He wants to help us live wisely in light of this reality. In chapter 3:14, he says, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that men will fear him. Unlike us, God does see and control the whole picture. And this vaporousness, the insubstantialness, this is a deliberate move by God to turn our attention to him as the one whom life is about, rather than all these other things. So when we get to chapter 5, the teacher is talking about what it means to fear God. In light of what he's observed about life under the sun, how should we respond as God's people? How should we approach him? And in this context, approach him at the temple in worship. And he urges them to be listeners, quick to listen and slow to speak. And of course, as God's people today, his message is for us too. We don't approach God with animal sacrifices as the Israelites did at a physical temple, but we approach God having been cleansed by the blood of the Lamb, Jesus, and as God's people who are being built into a new and living temple, Ephesians 2. For those who like seeing where they're going, this is where we're heading. In chapter 5, 1 to 7, the teacher urges us, thanks Phil, to be people who listen and obey, who watch our words, who fulfill our vows, and who, instead of dreaming, are grounded in the present. And all this can be summed up as fearing God. Verse 1 says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Draw near to listen rather than offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. The teacher urges caution in approaching God. And the person who doesn't exercise caution is called a fool. The fool doesn't approach God with reverence and obedience and can't see that his sacrifice is worthless and self-condemning. These words tell us that fool, it's not a fixed category. The teacher isn't addressing the unbeliever, but the temple-going, sacrifice-bringing Israelite. So as believers, we're not immune to being a fool. The Hebrew word for listen, shema, also means to obey. So guarding our steps and drawing near to listen is about being ready to obey what we hear. Listen and obey. In verses 2 to 3, the teacher is saying, watch your words. Verse 2, do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven and you are on earth, so let your words be few. So the reason that we're not to be hasty in speaking to God is God is in heaven and you are on earth. The teacher has looked around. He's experienced it all. If you remember in chapter 2, he tries everything. And in chapter 3:11, he comes to the conclusion that as creatures, we cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. But God is in heaven. So he views and directs the whole stage of creation and the whole stage of history from the rafters of the theater. God will bring the past to account, 3:15. All this calls for reverence and spareness of speech. This word havel, which means vapor, mist, meaningless, fleeting. It's explained in other Jewish writings like this. Imagine you have a pot of boiling water and you collect the steam from that boiling water into another pot. And you boil up that steam and then you collect the steam from that steam and you boil that up. And after you've re-steamed the steam seven times, you end up with the vapor of all vaporousness, the Hevel of Hevelim in chapter one. And then the Jewish writers apply this idea to biblical verses like in the Psalms, where David talks about humans being insubstantial in comparison to God. If you put humans on the scale on one side and you put vapor on the other side of the scale, the humans go up. That's how lightweight we are compared to God. So don't be casual with God. As Australians, I think that we like to think that everyone is our mate, you know, because we're so friendly and chilled out, relaxed. And I think this idea can extend to our idea of God. Even those who don't really profess faith sometimes say things like, God, yeah, he's my mate. We're on good terms. And of course, yes, Jesus calls us friend. But if our primary or our only way of seeing God is as our mate, then we're missing something very important. Verse 3. A dream comes when there are many cares, and many words mark the speech of a fool. The connection between dreams and cares, or busyness, sometimes it's translated, it's a bit unclear, but it's usually understood to mean that if you're always thinking and worrying about things, you're likely to have bad dreams about them. And in the same way, the more you talk, the more likely you'll say things that are foolish. I'm sure we can all relate to that. I wonder if, like Philip and I, you've ever given your spouse or your sibling a sharp kick under the dinner party table, or the old stop talking now signal, when you can see that they're on a roll and about to free fall into interpersonal disaster. Well, the teacher understood this phenomenon. There really is nothing new under the sun. And so he says, we should be listeners, not talkers. Oscar Wilde, the great playwright, had one of his characters say, I am so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word I'm saying. Jesus says, and when you pray, don't keep on babbling like pagans, for they think that they will be heard because of their many words. Don't be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Our Father in heaven, he sees the whole picture. So he already knows what we need. Our prayers should be frequent and faithful, but they don't have to be lengthy or clever. The pagan, the unbeliever, he's rambling. It dishonors God because he trusts in his many words, not in the God who hears them. We can't wrestle back control with lots of words. If you want to be wise, watch your words. In verses 4-6, the teacher again warns against being hasty or careless, this time when it comes to making vows. Verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to fulfill it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin. And don't protest to the temple messenger, my vow was a mistake. Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the work of your hands? It's foolish, the teacher says, to casually make a vow as if you're the one in control of the future and you're the one in control of the things that will allow you to fulfill it. For Israelites and throughout the ancient world, a vow was a commitment to God to do something if God answered your request. And a broken vow could bring human and divine retribution. There's a chilling story in Judges 11 where the warrior Jephthah says to God, if you give me victory over the Ammonites, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return from triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. When he does return, his daughter comes out to meet him, his only child, and she herself agrees that he must keep his vow because, as she says, you have given your word to the Lord. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Notice that Jesus' rationale for simplicity in speech is similar to that of the teacher. For heaven is God's throne and earth is his footstool. Everything belongs to God. Unlike God, we don't have access to what his purposes are in any given situation. Standing on this side of Jesus' death and resurrection, we do stand in a better place to understand God's purposes, but we still stand in the same world. We still stand on the stage, not up in the rafters. We're still within time, not outside it. In 2003, Philip and I went to stay in an incredibly remote village in Vanuatu as a kind of a look-see trip. On our first night, trying to get to sleep in a little bush hut, we were surrounded by spiders bigger than Philip's hand, real and imagined, and I was completely shell-shocked. And I made a sort of a vow to God. I said, okay, God, this isn't funny. If you let me off this whole Bible translation thing, I'll do anything you want me to do, anything but this. It was a foolish and desperate way to talk to God. I also told our organisation, Wycliffe, that I didn't think it was wise for us to be assigned to a place that was always hot and humid. Well, Papua, where we ended up living for 10 years, has two seasons, hot humid and hotter, humider. So many worries and concerns that made no difference to anything. We really don't see the whole picture, but God does. And he knows all our needs and all our limitations. James, the brother of Jesus, also writes a wisdom book. And in chapter 4, 13 to 17, he almost quotes Ecclesiastes. He says, now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to do this or that. We will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. This boasting. Lost my spot. There it is. This boasting, it is speaking as though we have more power and control than we really do. You are a mist, he says. We don't want the way that we speak to become tokenistic, where we won't make any kind of statement about the future without saying, if the Lord so wills. But on the other hand, we are shaped by the language we use, and we want the way we want to think and speak in ways that reflect the truth. So as we make plans, we need to be praying and entrusting things to the Lord and entrusting that sometimes God will do not the thing that we planned. In Papua, I worked with a really gifted young Bible translator, Agnes. She was so smart and so capable, and I was frustrated that she didn't have firmer plans for her future. She didn't have more focused ambition. But over time, I saw the wisdom in how she approached things. She took life as it came, she prayed a lot, she knocked on the doors available to her, didn't stress when things didn't work out. She often said, Kalo Tuhan kehendaki, which means if God wills. Well, right now, she's on a full government scholarship studying a master's in chemistry in Russia, in Russian, and learning Russian at the same time. Our translation team were sad to lose her to her chemistry studies, but who knows what her future holds? I think the teacher's warning in this passage about vows and how we speak to God is also relevant for the way we make promises to each other. When I was checking John's epistles for the Musun language recently, we came to the bit where John says, Let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. And I asked the community members about this, and one of them said, oh, yeah, this is like OMDOT. And it turns out OMDOT is this expression that has evolved in their language. It's a combination of the word omong, which means chatter or gossip, and doa, which means prayer. So OMDOT is the kind of empty prayer talk that Christians engage in. It's a great word, but not such a great habit. Let's not say, I'll pray for you, unless we're going to pray. Let's encourage each other to continue keeping the promises that we've made, our marriage promises, ordination promises, baptism promises. I think our culture values the talker and underestimates the value of silence and caution in speech. This idea has crept into our culture that if you don't say it, if you don't share it, then it didn't happen. Many people are desperately trying to give their lives substance and meaning through words and images. And now with the echo chamber of social media and the power of the algorithm, we're hearing our own thoughts and ideas replicated back to us round and around. And we're losing the ability to listen and interact well with different ideas and opinions. We're so busy trying to get attention that we've lost the art of paying attention. And the teacher cuts through all the noise. And he says, fear God, listen, slow down. God is in heaven and you are on earth, so let your words be few. If we listen well to God and to each other, then we'll have something worthwhile to say. Jesus himself knew when to speak and when to be silent. Under the greatest pressure, he held his tongue and entrusted himself to the Father. Jesus is the perfect teacher. In verse 7, thanks, Phil, the teacher again connects dreaming with too much talking. But in this verse, he seems to be talking more about daydreaming. He says, much dreaming and many words are meaningless. Therefore, fear God. The New Living Translation puts it like this. Talk is cheap, like daydreams and other useless activities. Fear God instead. The teacher is saying, be present. Fear God. So the opposite of daydreaming is paying attention to the present. And Ecclesiastes has a lot to say about time and how to live wisely within the reality of time. The past, the teacher says, it's evaporated like mist. You can't get it back. The future is God's and his alone. The only time we have is the present. So it's foolish to be constantly distracted or anxious, regretting the past or worrying about the future, so busy dreaming that you're inattentive to what's going on around you. We don't get to hold on to the present or to control it, but we do get to receive it and enjoy it as we're able. Perhaps you're raising young children and the house is a constant disaster. Marie Kondo would have a fit. Your books, they're still in mouldy boxes in the garage, definitely not arranged in rainbow colours. These are superficial examples, but when you're in a difficult season, it feels all-consuming, like it's never going to end. But the teacher reminds us that moment will go. Time will evaporate like a mist. It'll slip through your fingers. Be present. If you're in your middle years, like I am, make peace with the fact that your options are now limited. It's foolishness to be the person who abandons the family to go on a self-discovery silent retreat in Bali, leaving a trail of carnage behind. It's wisdom to say, okay, these are the decisions that I've made. These are my particular burdens, joys, strains. These are the people God has placed me among. This is the work God has given me, and I can make a significant impact on this finite group of people. Stop dreaming and get working within your God-given limitations, capacities, and aspirations. Instead of dreaming, verse 7, fear God. The antidote to foolishness, the way towards wisdom in these verses is fear of God. This is the opposite of thoughtless vows and vain excuses, empty words. Fear of God is the right response when we understand who God is, when we understand that God's words are very different to ours. The promises that he makes, he always fulfills. God's words determine our reality. His word brought the universe into being. His word, his promises to Abraham brought the nation of Israel into being. God's words bring healing, salvation. A great example of this is in 2 Samuel 7, where King David tells God that he'll build God a house, a temple. But God says, no, you won't make me a house. That's not my plan. No, I'll establish you into an eternal house, an eternal kingdom. It's God's words, his promises that shape the future. If we understand who God is, we'll watch our words and we won't get lost in our own dreaming and scheming. What we see in Ecclesiastes is that fear of God is not about being terrified because God is scary. It's a proper understanding of what it means to be a creature and a proper understanding of who God is as the creator and sustainer of life. In chapter 3, 12 to 13, the teacher says, I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. We're not to be like the fool who enjoys life but has no fear of God. Nor are we to be like the person who is reflective enough to see that there's no permanence in this life but then collapses into hopelessness. We're to be people who understand that God is in heaven, we are on earth. We are to be people who listen and obey, who watch our words, who keep our vows, and who are attentive to the present and our present commitments and opportunities. All this is what the teacher calls fear of the Lord, and this is what it means to be wise. So let's be wise and enjoy the good gifts God has given us.